This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we talk to the State Consumer Protection Administrator about a rising threat of cyber attacks and what we can do to protect our personal information. Now, the Respect for Marriage Act passed in the U.S. House last week. It would write into federal law the right to marry for same-sex and interracial couples. Here's Wisconsin Representative and co-sponsor of the bill, Mark Pocan, speaking on the floor of the House.
Here's what I want. I want to make sure that my husband, Phil, can visit me in the hospital should I have to go back again, like when I had a triple bypass a few years ago. I want to make sure my husband has my earned benefits for retirement and Social Security. I want to make sure that my husband is taken care of just like your spouses are taken care of. If I was the entity on the other side of the aisle, I'd be more concerned when my own members accuse it of having cocaine-fueled orgies than worrying about the morality of my marriage. I yield back.
There's a similarly named bill in the U.S. Senate where Wisconsin Senator Tammy Baldwin says she's working directly with Republicans to try to find enough votes to prevent a filibuster and pass it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about this push in Congress to put into law marriage rights for same-sex couples in particular? This would also include interracial couples. How high a priority is this for you? Do you worry that the U.S. Supreme Court would overrule past decisions of the Supreme Court that allowed same-sex marriage in states around the country? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Kimmy King is interim chair and distinguished teaching professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of North Texas. Kimmy, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be back.
Let's set the stage a little bit here. This all kind of starts with the Supreme Court and the Roe v. Wade decision, overturning the Roe v. Wade precedent. Why did that get people in Congress talking about same-sex marriage?
The big reason why it did is because Justice Thomas, in his concurring opinion, went even further than what the court had said in the Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization. That's the case that said, in terms of an abortion, there isn't a substantive due process right there. It needs to go back to the states. And so we go back to this patchwork that is our system of federalism. And it's because Thomas said, look, here we're saying there's not a fundamental right to abortion. And the majority opinion is not saying what I'm going to say, which is it raises the specter that once we overturn this substantive due process right, there are other rights that should be looked at, like the right to marital contraception, the right to marriage equality. And so it's from that that you are seeing this push to prevent the court from doing what they did in Dobbs.
Now, there is a federal law related to same-sex marriage on the books in the 1990s, the Defense of Marriage Act. This goes back to the Clinton administration. Can you remind us what that act did?
Yeah, so the Respect for Marriage Act would, in essence, repeal the Defense of Marriage Act, DOMA, which is a 1996 law backed by Clinton that defined marriage for federal purposes as a union between one man and one woman. And so it was to address that patchwork of marriage laws to make it clear what the rule of law ought to be.
If this Respect for Marriage Act passes, as more or less written in the House, what exactly does it do, apart from, as you say, repealing the Defense of Marriage Act?
Yeah, so it at least provides some federal ground for LGBTQ rights. You also have to remember that the Supreme Court has actually said that there are LGBTQ rights in employment law under the Civil Rights Act. So it's interesting that the Supreme Court has recognized LGBTQ rights in that context. It's in this issue of marriage equality that there becomes this concern. And so all it would do would be to provide a firm federal stance on it, recognize that the Supreme Court has the ability to weigh in on laws. Most certainly the law would be challenged because in this kind of polarized environment, everything is being challenged.
We're talking to Kimmy King from the University of North Texas, political scientist there, looking at an effort in Congress to pass a Respect for Marriage Act. It's passed the House, supported by Democrats, some Republicans there. Now the Senate open question. What's going to end up happening there? Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Pat is with us in Green Bay. Pat, hi.
Hello there. Hopefully you still have me. I love what Congress is trying to do and the Senate, but what is going on with our Supreme Court that it's like they're going backwards. Instead of trying to help people, they're trying to destroy. I don't get it. What is the thought process there?
Pat, thanks for the call. Kimmy, Pat worried that the U.S. Supreme Court has kind of reversed course over the last few years.
Well, and the question I think that Pat is also getting at that's implied is what does it mean for a whole other set of laws? Recall that the civil rights movement really began pushing in the 30s, 40s, but started to have success in the 50s, and then especially in the 60s with things like voting rights. And so one of the comments that's been made, and there is a case before the court next fall, which will be looking at voting rights and would return greater power to the states over voting rights. And that's the reason why we have the 1965 Voting Rights Act in the first place. I mean, some have commented that this year it's 1973 out of the Supreme Court, and next year it'll be 1963. The argument that I think the conservative justices might try to make is that we are using originalism and we are trying to look at what the Constitution said. And it fundamentally boils down to this view of whether you see the Constitution as a document that evolves in terms of granting more rights, or whether that if you want to grant more of those rights, the legislatures have to make it explicit and they have to set it down, because Congress could have solved this issue back in 1974. In fact, in the days after Roe v. Wade was decided, there was a push to try to codify it. And over time, there have been attempts to do it, but they didn't do it. The Congress didn't have the political will. It'll be curious to see whether they have the political will in this case. They got 47 Republicans on board. That's a lot more than they did last year when they were trying to provide for additional LGBTQ rights.
Thanks for that call, Pat. One common argument from Republicans opposed to putting this law into place, some have head on said, you know, they don't support same-sex marriage, but some have said, we're not worried about same-sex marriage, but we're not worried about the Supreme Court overturning its same-sex marriage ruling. So you shouldn't either. This is just a distraction. Not going to happen. People supporting the law said, well, wait a minute. We thought Roe v. Wade was settled law, and that wasn't going to happen either. What do you think about that argument that it's kind of an unnecessary sideshow?
Yeah, the reality is that in 1989, Justice Scalia wrote in a concurring opinion regarding a decision that what the court was doing was they were setting the groundwork, and that someday we would look back at that 1989 decision and say Roe v. Wade has been effectively overruled. And nobody listened to Scalia then. And the result is where we find ourselves today with the Dobbs decision. You just can't know who's going to wind up on the court. Nobody would have predicted that President Trump was going to have the opportunity to put on three justices. Even Ruth Bader Ginsburg recognized back in the 1970s that the abortion rights were fragile, especially because of the state situation. And there are some who are arguing that, you know, God bless her, RBG Ginsburg should have stepped down sooner because that might have made a difference here. But instead, she held on. And it's those three justices that have been put on that have made the difference.
We're talking about proposed legislation working its way through Congress aimed at putting into law marriage equality for same-sex and interracial couples, those protected currently by Supreme Court decisions. But what happens if the Supreme Court reverses those decisions? Kimmy King is with us from the University of North Texas, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see Congress, the House already did it, the Senate maybe? Do you want to see the Senate pass a bill like this saying, yes, same-sex marriage is legal here in the United States? Do you agree with what we've heard from Republicans, that this is just a sideshow, that this isn't something that's likely to happen, overturning Roe v. Wade? Do you have wider questions about the idea of privacy rights and whether they are real rights, something that should be taken seriously by courts? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're talking with Kimmy King from the Department of Political Science at the University of North Texas, looking at the Respect for Marriage bill in Congress, aimed at protecting same-sex marriage in the event of a Supreme Court reversal of past rulings. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Bill is with us in Madison. Bill, hi.
Hi. I'm looking at what Tony Barrett said. She's an originalist, meaning the original way the Constitution was written. And interracial marriage was not written into the Constitution. If she stays with that, and Thomas, who also used that for turning over Roe Wade, then Thomas has to divorce his white wife. That's illegal, and women's rights were not in the Constitution, so she has to leave the Supreme Court because that's illegal. So originalists, and this is going on. So it's kind of like they're writing their own demise if they use the same premise of what overturned Roe Wade. So what Congress is pushing through, yeah, that should have been through a long time ago. I definitely support that.
Bill,
rights for marriage.
Thanks a lot for the call. Kimmy, Bill saying, where does originalism stop?
So I think one of the things that's interesting that your caller is pointing out is that this is part of the debate about originalism. Now, what, again, the conservative justices would say to you was that there are these fundamental freedoms that we have. And the question is, what constitutes a fundamental freedom? And so the right to, I think the interesting point about interracial marriage and certainly women being able to serve on the courts. In fact, there's a decision from the late 1800s that said that women were too gentle. Their nature did not allow them to serve in the courts. And so they were denied being able to have access to that kind of participation. It really fundamentally boils down to how you view the Constitution and those fundamental freedoms. And we go back to this idea of the role of the states in protecting those freedoms. I also want to hit something quickly that the caller is getting at, mm-hmm. that you also raised, and that is, you know, this, well, there's really no threat here. Just keep in mind that there have been 300 anti-transgender and anti-LGBTQ bills proposed in state legislatures just in 2022. In the past 3 years, 20 new anti-transgender laws have become law. And so there's a whole host of issues related to abortion or to marriage equality and gender identity that are also going to be subject to state restrictions given the court's circumstances, you know, what the position that the court has taken here.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Rebecca joins us now in Newton. Rebecca, hi.
Yes, hi. I just had a quick question about how we could get more justices on the Supreme Court. I know that's always a discussion. They're always talking about it. Is it a hard process for them to go through? And who decides if we can do that?
Rebecca, thanks for the call. The number 9, I don't think, is in the Constitution when it comes to the number of justices, Kimmy. That said, it's not easy peasy to change that number.
No, it started at 6, went up to 7, back to 6, up to 9, then to 10, back down to 9 in the late 1860s and has been held there since. FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, tried to pack the court in the 1930s, because the Supreme Court kept striking down what he thought were his perfectly good laws that Congress had passed. And it really didn't go anywhere, in part because two of the justices on the court began magically seeing FDR's position and began switching their votes. I don't think that's likely to change here, But I'm also very clear that it's Congress that makes those determinations. And I think that given the tenuous nature of where Congress is at and how divided we are, I don't see that happening. Both, you know, abortion, marriage equality, and changing the size of the Supreme Court all come back to the political will of Congress. And there's an argument to be made here. Congress doesn't have any spine, that Congress is avoiding these issues. And they like to talk the rhetoric when it serves them for come election time, but that the reality is until they are forced to deal with it, they're not going to deal with it. And that's why I think the Republican Party is going to have some difficult issues. So to get at your caller's question, the real issue you've got to get around is that on marriage equality, in terms of support, public opinion show that between 6 and 10 registered voters, and actually some polls say as high as 70%, with almost 35% of Republicans saying that they support marriage equality, is going to be difficult for hardcore, you know, very conservative folks to be able to get around, because they've lost in some ways the support of their party on the marriage equality issue. And that's a little different from what you see in the abortion case.
Kimmy, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
You betcha. As always, love that public radio.
Kimmy King is interim chair and distinguished teaching professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of North Texas. We talked to her today about proposed legislation known as the Respect for Marriage Act. The U.S. House passed a version that would confirm a right to marry for same-sex and interracial couples. That bill is now under negotiation over in the U.S. Senate. Lake Superior tribe has been embroiled in a years-long legal battle with the Canadian energy firm Enbridge after it sued to remove the company's oil and gas pipeline from tribal lands. As a result, Enbridge is seeking permits to route its Line 5 pipeline around the Bad River Band's reservation. Now, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency says a state review didn't fully account for ways that the project could harm the environment and tribal resources. Danielle Kading has more.
With the sun blazing, tribal and environmental advocates gather on a road where Enbridge's Line 5 crosses the Bad River Reservation. The pipeline carries up to 23 million gallons of Canadian crude oil and natural gas liquids daily from Superior to Sarnia, Ontario. The tribe's natural resources director, Naomi Tillison, says the tribal council rejected renewal of easements for the pipeline due to the threat of an oil spill.
That's why the council said we are not going to renew these because we need to protect our water.
While the tribe's case is ongoing, Enbridge wants to reroute around 40 miles of Line 5. Critics have already blasted a draft environmental review of the project conducted by the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. They say there's not enough information to lawfully grant a permit, and EPA staff agree. The EPA's regional administrator, Deborah Shore, told WPR's The Morning Show they reviewed and offered input on the state's draft.
We think that many of the comments we provided to take climate change into account and to do a much more thorough review of the potential impact on tributaries and on those wetlands will assist in a better review.
The federal agency sent the DNR nearly 200 recommendations to strengthen its review. The Tyler Forks River cascades down to join the Bad River within Copper Falls State Park. EPA staff say the Line 5 reroute may have substantial and unacceptable impacts on the Bad River and the Caucagan Bad River sloughs. Overlooking the falls, Tillison says lake sturgeon spawn in the river and wild rice grows in the internationally recognized wetlands.
That's really, really important to the Bad River tribal members. It's part of the migration story where they migrated to find the food that grows on water, and that's wild rice.
The agency wants the DNR to show Enbridge's plans wouldn't negatively affect state and tribal water quality standards. The EPA also wants to see more details about the project's contribution to greenhouse gas emissions and how climate change could affect it. Walking through tall grass, a group treks into a wooded ravine where a creek runs under washed-out railroad tracks.
See the railroad tracks dangling in the air?
That's Joan Elias. She owns about 190 acres, and some of that land runs next to the project. Elias says after 10 inches of rain flooded creeks and rivers one night in 2016, she was temporarily stranded.
It was washed out along Little Edwards Road. It was washed out here.
Opponents say more frequent intense storms driven by climate change only increase the threat of an oil spill along the pipeline's route. Tribal members also fear the project will harm treaty rights to hunt, fish, and gather. Lacoutere tribal member Don White with the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission points out Wisconsin made it a felony for people to go on an energy provider's property without consent.
For folks who just don't have a lot of resources, it is not in the best interests of tribes to diminish any sort of access.
The EPA doesn't have a lead role permitting the project, but the federal agency is coordinating with state regulators and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. The Corps says its goal is to resolve EPA's concerns. The DNR says they're addressing issues with those agencies as well as Enbridge. An Enbridge spokesperson maintains the company is committed to protecting the environment, and the Canadian firm stresses the pipeline is a vital energy link for the region. Business manager Joel Zilke with the local 601 Steamfitters Union agrees.
That's a lot of gas and diesel and propane for people that really rely on that, you know, at this point still.
Zilke also touted the 700 jobs the project would create, along with millions in state tax revenues. Enbridge plans to break ground once all permits are granted, but it's clear federal regulators want to know a lot more before they make any final decisions. Daniel Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, tomorrow marks the anniversary of the passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act back in 1990. Find out what led to the passage of the law and the impact it's had over the last three decades. Plus, a look at the challenges that still remain today with new lawsuits related to elections and other issues still in the works related to the ADA. Also on The Morning Show tomorrow, monarch butterflies are now endangered, according to an international wildlife organization. You can find out why and what everyday people can do to help. And if you've participated in one of the many local efforts aimed at preserving habitat for monarch butterflies, we'll want to hear from you. You can get started right now. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Do you have some butterfly-friendly plants in your own backyard? If you work for a business or a city, say a local government that maintains some sides of highways, do you have some butterfly-friendly plants going on? Do you have a backyard milkweed farm like I do, sort of accidentally? That's all coming up tomorrow here on the Ideas Network. Lambeau Field, the frozen tundra, legendary venue for football. Turned into Lambeau Field, the soggy tundra for a different kind of football this weekend. On Saturday evening, a sold-out Lambeau played host to two of the world's best soccer clubs, Manchester City from England and Bayern Munich from Germany, both champions of their respective leagues. Wisconsin fans and fans from all over put their best foot forward to welcome the European teams to the first ever soccer match held at Lambeau. Wisconsin's weather was not quite as welcoming, with heavy rains, which they played through, but lightning storms, which caused two delays and evacuations of the field and stands. I was lucky enough to be there. It was worth the delays and rain to see the best soccer playing I'll probably ever see in person in my life. Plus, I had a rain jacket, water-resistant shoes, change of clothes for the ride home. Final score, Man City 1, Bayern München 0, and Lambeau Field fans 1, Wisconsin weather 0. Both very spirited matches. I'm mostly dried off now. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we'll find out why women of color may face some of the biggest consequences at the end of Roe v. Wade and of abortion bans in Wisconsin and elsewhere. Now, the Milwaukee office of the FBI announced last week that the volume of cyber threats in Wisconsin is rising. Special Agent in Charge Michael Hensley said businesses and residents are at heightened risk and should be alert for ransomware attacks and email schemes. Our next guest says we can take steps to watch out for cyber attacks and to keep our information safe. Lara Sutherland is Division of Trade and Consumer Protection Administrator for the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. Lara, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Let's look at a couple of the concerns here. Ransomware, all of us have probably seen it in headlines, might not know what it is. What is ransomware?
So ransomware is a type of malware, and malware is abbreviated for malicious software. And basically what ransomware does is it locks users out of their devices or encrypts their personal data, making it inaccessible. And then it threatens the victim into paying a ransom to unlock it. Sometimes they'll demand money via hard-to-trace cryptocurrencies or through gift cards or wiring. But essentially, it is a way in which scammers or criminals will infect your computer and prevent you from accessing it, and then force you to pay them in some form to get access back to your computer.
And then there's email schemes, often called phishing, with a PH, phishing. What is that? What should we be watching out for?
So phishing is very common, and we have gotten over 2,400 complaints related to phishing just in last year alone. And it's a way in which scammers and criminals try to lure us into clicking on links and having this infection happen to our computers. So what you'll see are text messages, emails, where they look very, very sophisticated, maybe from your HR department, maybe from your real estate agent, maybe from your family or your friends, and they contain malicious links in them that you click, and then your computer is then infected. Or they ask you for information that you think might be legitimate, and in fact it's not, and you have been taken advantage of by either giving some individual or entity your social security number, your bank information, or some other personal identifying information.
Now, people might hear about cyber attacks and think, oh, you know, maybe people want to attack government institutions or big businesses or something. They're not going to care about little me or maybe my mom and pop business down the street or whatever. Can you send the message out that, yeah, we're all maybe potential targets here?
Absolutely. On the contrary, phishing and identity theft is increasingly on the rise. The FTC is reporting it rising year after year. And here in Wisconsin, it is our number three complaint at last year, and looking like it will be at the top of the list again this year. And where ID theft typically happens is through these types of attacks, through phishing, through malware, through spyware. And so folks need to be very savvy about paying attention to texts or emails that look a little unusual. And they are, as I say, getting more and more sophisticated. There are entire criminal rings that actually train people how to write an email that it looks compelling. They have an infrastructure now where people are learning how to write in English and learning how to write grammatically correct and learning how to lure you into believing that they are the government or they are your family member or they are your real estate agent, as I say. So if you get an email or a text that looks a little strange, that you're not expecting that kind of information or that request from somebody, use a separate form of information to contact that person. So in other words, if you get an email from your real estate agent, you're surprised that you're getting it, use a number or an email that you know that is accurate, pick up the phone, call them, did you send this to me? I bet 90% of the time they didn't, they've been hacked and you've been a victim of a phishing scam.
All right, that's some good prevention technique there for those suspicious emails. What are some other steps we can take to help prevent malware from taking over computers, other kinds of things you commonly run into at the agency?
Well, so folks should really take seriously keeping their computers, their software, their phones, everything up to date. There are a fair amount of ways in which all of these companies are working hard to prevent malware and spyware and phishing attempts because companies are losing money as well. So you have apps on your phone that you should keep up to date. You should keep your antivirus software on your computer up to date. That is one way you can protect yourself. Never, ever give out personal identifying information to someone or an entity that you don't recognize or trust. You know, as I said earlier, really make sure that you can verify where you're getting these requests from. And if you can't, ignore it. Use search engines to verify or check if anyone else has reported a scam. If you get something, do a little research yourself and say, this looks a little bit too good to be true. Go online in your search engine, search within scam or complaint, and oftentimes you'll find out this is a common scam that is going around and that you should be wary of it. You know, if anyone sends you some money, you may not be able to recover it. So absolutely think about when someone is asking you for money, asking you for a gift card, asking you to pay in untraceable ways like cryptocurrency. That is a real sign that you're not engaging with somebody who's legitimate and it's a scam and that you should avoid it.
Now, suppose, Laura, despite our best efforts, it goes wrong. And we know somebody's got our information. They've been able to use our credit card or whatever. Or they're ransoming us now. What do we do?
Well, first of all, you should give the department a call. We have an ID theft team that can help you figure out whether or not your identification has been jeopardized and steps that you can take to protect it, like putting on a credit freeze. Things of that nature, working with your banking institution, your financial institution to help you perhaps shut down accounts or retrieve money that may have been stolen. So definitely give our hotline a call at 1-800-422-7128 and talk to the folks there. You can also get your credit report, and I would encourage you to do that if you think you've been a victim of an identity theft or your bank account or your identity has been jeopardized. I would definitely get your credit report and see if there's any unusual things happening with your credit.
Laura, can you leave us with that number one more time where people can report if they've been hacked?
Absolutely. It's 1-800-422-7128. And you can visit our website at datcp.wi.gov. We have lots of information about ID theft and how to keep yourself safe and some of the information I talked about here today.
Laura, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Laura Sutherland with the Division of Trade and Consumer Protection for the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade and Consumer Protection, with us today to help identify potential cyber threats and protect our personal information online. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary Kate McCoy with a story about poetry and farming.
The poetry in Daniel Smith's book, Ancestral, reflects on life and farming in the Driftless area of Wisconsin. WPR's Tim Peterson spoke with him about his poetry on an early spring day in his barn near Arena, Wisconsin. Smith shared three poems about heritage, loss, and an appreciation for the wild.
I thought I would start with a poem called Anvil, which deals with the move to this land that we are standing on this morning and leaving our ancestral home, a farm in northwestern Illinois. Anvil. I've hauled my father's anvil due north, up out of the black Illinois farm ground he and I together worked decades our home. Set down 60 pounds onto the floor of this old barn, new only to me. All around, our bewildered tools hang in the strange light of the cracked window pane, where I stand looking out over land not yet home. It is growing late on a late winter's day. At my feet, my father's anvil, his striking song of steel on steel, still hammering home. This next poem is about a neighbor of mine who passed away several years ago. A man had welcomed us to our new home here in Wisconsin and then suddenly became ill and passed away. And it's called A Farmer Dies in Springtime. Home from the hospital to a bed with a view of the fields. Tended by hospice, who arrive morning and night like a hired man come to chore. Neighbors stop by, sit bedside, stare into their hands, red and cracked from winter. They recall the year of the early frost, flood, or big drought. They avoid talk of the plowing or planting, of the futures for cattle or corn. The tractor, disc, and planter stay locked in the shed with seed bought months ago when the new catalogs arrived, glossy with promise and primed for a year that would not be. Now that I have grandchildren, one of my inspirations for writing is to share things with them that I hope they'll read when they get older, and that they still live in a world that gives them beauty and an appreciation of nature. One day while I was walking, I came across a red fox, which is rare to find in the open, and I wrote this poem for my grandchildren called The Red Fox. I saw a red fox drinking from the horse pail in the pasture south of the barn. A winter sunset blazed upon his hide, and his black ears pointed toward the early stars. Suddenly aware, he bolted for the dark woods, but I did not follow. It was enough to know he exists, to know this world still shelters the rare and the wild.
Daniel Smith is a poet and president and CEO of Cooperative Network. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
Coming up, find out why women of color may see a big impact from the overturning of Roe v. Wade. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. Now, women of color may see the biggest impacts of the end of Roe v. Wade. According to the Kaiser Family Foundation, black women seek abortions more than three times as often as white women, and Hispanic women seek abortions almost twice as often. And Marie Benitez is the Senior Director of Government Relations at the National Latina Institute for Reproductive Justice. And Marie, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Rob, for having me. I'm excited to be on the show.
What are some of the reasons that women of color might be disproportionately impacted by the overturning of Roe?
I think this is a very important question to ask because it is our communities that historically face several structural barriers when accessing care in all of its forms. Right now, our communities are a significant disadvantage when we're talking about access to living wage jobs, to paid sick days, insurance coverage, affordable housing, and childcare. And when you put some of these systemic barriers into place and you imagine somebody just trying to get a clinic, getting to a clinic with these structural barriers, then you have a better understanding of why it is our communities, women of color, Latinas, Black women, Indigenous, AAPI communities, and working families are the most impacted. So, for example, if I am somebody who's undocumented and is trying to get to a clinic that's past a checkpoint, I can't do that for fear of being deported. Or if I am somebody who has a job that's schedule is continuously changing, then I can't schedule the time that I need to go get the care that I need or even get sick days off or find somebody who's going to take care of my children. So all of these impact somebody just getting basic care. And we fundamentally believe that access to abortion care is a human right. So that is why our communities are the most impacted.
Can you talk about access to birth control in particular?
Yes. It is something that has a lot of history involved in it too. I wish that you can provide a direct answer here. But when it comes to contraception, there's, do you have a doctor? Do you have a clinic nearby you? Can you afford the coverage that you have? So access to contraception varies across the country and varies across communities, and particularly within the Latina community. So as we all know, we're hearing from legislators, and we're even hearing from the anti-abortion movement, contraception, and even also hearing it from the judges from the Supreme Court, contraception is something that's also being considered as part of the table. So our bodily autonomies are constantly under attack. And when I talked about the history, raising that up, that we know that it's been constantly attacked because, for example, contraception and or sterilization have been something that also has been taken out of our hands, like through the histories of Puerto Rico, when it comes to contraception or forced sterilization, or even recent stories in California in the prison system within there. Women are being forced to do things that they do not want to have done to their bodies. So in addition to these barriers, we have to ask these questions. Is this being done for me? Is this being forced upon me? Who do I trust? Where do I go? It becomes not only a change that needs to be happening systematically, but also we also need to have the conversations of culture shaping, culture shifting and shaping these policies so that people know they can get the care they need when they need it and when they want it.
We're talking to Anne Marie Benitez with the National Latina Institute for Reproductive Justice, looking at the impact of Roe v. Wade on women of color in particular. Anne Marie, I know we have disparities in Wisconsin and elsewhere when it comes to maternal mortality rates, based on race. What kind of things do you see around the country?
Yeah, and particularly also we have, so to take a step back, National Latina Institute for Reproductive Justice, we have folks on the ground in Virginia, in Florida, in New York, and in Texas. And we have seen in Texas, those numbers are just abysmal in terms of accessing care and the maternal mortality rates there. And it's because women's health hasn't been centralized. Women's health hasn't been prioritized. We hear all of these fights and attacks when it comes to abortion, but it's all interrelated. It's all reproductive healthcare services because it is healthcare. So if you look at states in which there are abortion bans, you will see also that there is negative access to reproductive health care. You will see an impact on maternal mortality. You will see that because once you attack one system or one component of reproductive health care, you're impacting the full structure. And that's what we're facing here. And that's why we constantly are fighting for what we say, salud, dignidad, y justicia, which is health, dignity, and justice for all to access care.
Given that Roe v. Wade has been overturned, abortion bans are kicking in Wisconsin and other states around the country, apart from advocating for that to change, what kind of things are you at the Latina Institute for Reproductive Justice doing to try to help women in those states?
Yeah, one of my key messages that I like to lift up is, you know, when you even just looking at the maps and seeing how abortion is becoming illegal in several states, in these times, it's easy to get lost and to lose hope. But I would urge that now is the time to get yourself included and involved and look for opportunities locally to get involved, because this is going to be a multi-pronged effort. Like I said, there's systematic changes that need to happen, healthcare changes that need to be happening, and lots of conversations that need to be happening. So now's the time to mobilize and get involved. And actually, many people don't know who their local state legislators are. Find out who they are. State sessions are coming up in January of 2023. And find out who they are. Vote so you can have an influence of who they're going to be. This is the time to get involved and to get educated. One place to go is our website, which is latinainstitute.org, and you can follow us on our social media channels as well if you're interested in getting plugged in and learning more about this issue.
Apart from abortion laws in particular, Anne Marie, just in our last minute, what other things, what maybe investments would you see being helpful for providing better reproductive care for women of color?
I wish there was like one answer, you know, like this is how you do it and this is how we need to do it. But I'm going to go back to, it's truly a multi-pronged effort. And if we really see abortion as part of reproductive health care and really focus towards a vision where each person has bodily autonomy, period. That is what we need to be working on and supporting policies in place that will accomplish that. So it shouldn't matter where you live, who you are, your immigration status. It's about full bodily autonomy.
Anne Marie, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for your time and energy.
That's Anne Marie Benitez, Senior Director of Government Relations at the National Latina Institute for Reproductive Justice, with us today looking at the lack of access to health services for women of color and why the end of Roe v. Wade could have a particularly big impact on them. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, a long-running rule lets election clerks fill in some missing address info for witnesses of absentee ballots. Republican state lawmakers say they have to stop. They don't fit into current law. We'll get the latest on this ballot curing debate. And a new book traces the 200-year history of efforts to treat mental illness in the United States and finds a lot of missed opportunities through the present day. We'll meet the author of the book, Desperate Remedies. That's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.